Arts Connection, the intersection of faith and the arts in Canadian culture. With your host, Robert White. Now, here's Robert.
Welcome to Arts Connection. With her successful Port Aster Secrets trilogy brought to a close, tonight's guest has embarked on another romantic suspense series, this time featuring a rookie FBI agent, art, and a long unsolved murder of a loved relative. Sandra Orchard's latest book, A Fool and His Monet, has recently been released by Revell Books, and Sandra's on the phone with us from her home office in the Niagara Peninsula to talk about the book. But before we get to our interview, let's listen to Trouble Won't Go from Carla Adolph's Live at the Space CD.
Trouble won't go and peace won't stay. Oceans roar, levees break. Trouble won't go and peace won't stay. Bridges fall and the earth gives way.
Conversation with Sandra Orchard. Good evening, Sandra.
Hello, Robert.
Now, I think the last time we talked, you were just wrapping up your Port Aster Secrets series. Go back to that point in time, and as you were wrapping that up, and I know in conversations I've had with other writers and that, especially fiction writers, the characters become kind of real to them. What was it like when you knew that that would be potentially be the last time you wrote about Kate Adams and Tom Parker and the other Port Aster Secrets characters?
I was ready to say goodbye to them. I'm actually working on the final book in the Serena Jones Mysteries, which is what you're talking about with me today.
Yeah.
And I'm not ready to let her go, but the Port Aster Secrets one, it went over many, many years, and yeah, I was happy to be done.
And when you get to that part, and I want to get into the details on Serena Jones in a few minutes, but walk us through the whole creative process. Like, when did you start thinking about a new series and a new character? Like you said, Port Aster, you were getting to the point where you were tiring of that. So when did you actually start thinking about a new series and a new character?
Well, since I was writing for two publishers, I was coming up with new ideas all the time. And at the end, so when I'm handing in my final Port Aster book, they're asking for pitches for new stories. And I actually proposed romantic suspense, but they wanted to continue with mysteries. So it was basically July that I was coming up with more mysteries, ideas, and the contract came in September. I pitched it as a Stephanie Plum-type character involving art crime, and I'd never actually read a Stephanie Plum book. I just knew that it was a lighter kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
So once my editor said, yeah, I love that idea, I had to actually go and read those kind of books to figure out, okay, this is what I propose.
Right. Well, looking at all this and looking at the creative process, and we've seen this this whole discussion on social media about, you know, are you a plotter or a pantser? You know, the whole aspect of a plotter being somebody who sits down and pretty well outlines the whole book from beginning to end before they even sit down and start writing, where a pantser is somebody who has an idea, you know, has an idea of where it's going to go, but just, you know, sort of sits down and starts writing by the seat of their pants. Do you define yourself as either one of those as you develop both characters and start the writing process?
I used to be a total plotter, and I, about fifth book I wrote, about 1 month before the deadline, I realized the villain I thought was the villain wasn't the villain, and so then suddenly I became a pantser as I was writing the end of the book and discovered how much fun it was and why pantsers love to write that way. But I wouldn't write a book from beginning to end that way, because there's too many revisions that need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to plot my main turning points. I definitely know the main flaws of my characters, their strengths, their weaknesses, that sort of thing. But I often let myself get onto rabbit trails, which actually mess up the plot, and then I have to decide, do I peel it back and go back to what I had planned, or do I go off in this new direction? And sometimes I decide the new direction is definitely better, but it throws everything into a tailspin as to what I've planned. So then I become a little more of a pantser toward the end of the book.
And I'm supposing, too, when you're writing mysteries, especially as you have to, you know, you've got certain elements of the mystery genre in the twists and the plot twists and the red herrings and things like that, that it would help to actually have that kind of plotted out beforehand instead of trying to come up with it on the fly.
Well, what I always do is I make suspects, all of which who could be the villain. And by not deciding who the villain is, so for this third book that I'm just finishing, I had changed my mind through all four of the possible, there's actually more than that, but four main possible bad guys. And at one point in the story, each and every one could have been the bad guy in my mind. And the advantage of that is that it keeps the reader guessing, because I'm still guessing. So I'm planting clues that could point to any one of them.
Mm-hmm. And I saw that happening in The Fool and His Monet, and it wasn't sort of until the end that you sort of get a fairly clear idea of who the final villain was.
Good. I'm glad to hear it kept you guessing.
So, anyway, I think we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and continue our conversation with author Sandra Orchard. I'm your host, Robert White, and you're listening to Arts Connection on Faith FM.
Treasure.
Welcome back to Arts Connection. You've been listening to Child of the King from Carla Adolph's Live at the Space CD. I'm your host, Robert White. We're to continue our conversation with author Sandra Orchard. You mentioned earlier that you based the Serena Jones character on, or the Serena Jones mysteries on another author whose name I can't remember right now. But what sort of led you to that, ultimately to that choice of choosing a rookie FBI agent in the art crime team as your protagonist?
Well, the art crime, I had been reading a newspaper article about a Montreal police detective who he actually founded one of the top art theft units in the world. And it was a fascinating article. The FBI, they estimate that the international black market in art is worth something like $6 billion. So I could see a lot of great fodder for a series. And I anticipated that this could be an ongoing long series, like the Stephanie Plum books, which is what I had mentioned earlier.
Yep.
And I had previously done a love-inspired suspense that involved art crime. So I had done a lot of research for that. I'd read biographies of art detectives and of thieves, and actually found blogs written by former, they claim, art thieves. So I had lots of material. But I liked the idea of having a witty, competent, Miss Congeniality type FBI agent who would have a couple of interesting fellows in her life, but not really be a romance until the final book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what I pitched, and then I had a lot of fun inserting other characters. Like, she has this zany great aunt,
yep,
who you get a hint of that she's a lot more than she appears to be, and even some of the people.
It's almost a Miss Marple, Jessica Fletcher type character in there.
Yeah. There's some things you don't seem to know about the apartment superintendent and different people in her life. They all have a little bit of a secret.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had fun exploring those over the course of the series. My mind, of course, is already in the third book as we're talking about the first book. So.
And that, I mean, that's a challenge in the publishing area, because the way it goes is like you say, this one has just come out, but you're already, you know, 2-3 books ahead in that whole process.
Yes.
Now you chose St. Louis as the main setting. Was there a reason behind choosing that particular city?
Yes, I wanted to go to a conference there. There was a writing conference there, and I did some research, and I found out that there was an FBI headquarters there that actually had an art crime team agent on staff, which, considering there's only 13 in all of the U.S., was wonderful. And so I wrote them, and I got permission to actually go into the building, and they have to do a security check and everything. and I interviewed the art crime team agent, and I met Serena's colleagues, and I actually had a critique partner who had just moved there a month before the conference, and I stayed with her, and she toured me around the town, and her sister-in-law had lived there all her life, and so she gave us a tour of all the neighborhoods. So there'd be like the hill where the Italians live, and then there's Dogtown, which tends to be the Irish, and the different neighborhoods. So I got a flavor of all of that and how I might use it in the book. It was a really awesome research trip.
And but you also, I mean, you also throw in other locations as well. I mean, it's the story starts out in Buffalo, and you know, there's other. I'm sure with some of the other stories, or there are going to be other locations in that. Do you try to get to a location that you're writing about to get a good idea of it, or do you just do enough research behind the scenes to know what the community's like?
As much as I can, I try to go there. Ever since writing Perilous Waters, which was set in Alaska, I've really appreciated how having been there strengthens the writing, strengthens the setting, especially in suspense and mystery. So much of how you describe the setting, which you don't do in a lot of detail, but word choice is so important, gives you the mood of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so just having those details helps a lot. And yeah, with the internet and Google Maps and pictures and that, you can learn a lot. But for this, the third book I'm working on now is Martha's Vineyard. So, yeah, I had to go down there and research that for sure.
Oh, I bet you that was a really tough research trip.
Oh. Yeah, I had to go a second time just to make sure I had it right.
Uh-huh. Without spoiling it, though, and we've been talking all around it right now, but can you give us a little bit of the plot behind A Fool and His Monet?
So there's an art theft, and Serena has to figure out who stole it. And yeah, it's pretty hard not to give away the plot. There's lots of suspects. There's a former intern who has disappeared, and there's a person who seems to be involved with the senator. And her boss, there seems to be some political intrigue in terms of her boss not wanting to go there in that investigation. And, of course, any employee is suspect because they have means, opportunity. It's actually fairly... Museums don't have the greatest security. They're getting better, but... Yeah.
Okay. Well, we do know that painting that is stolen is a Monet. Again, did you do research on the artists and the works that they had created in order to give that that realism to the book?
I didn't do too much research on the art per se, more on how the crimes happen, why they happen. I actually was part of an antiquities course this past February, just as this book was releasing. The course was for my third book. And the professor who taught that asked if she could review The Fool and His Monet. And she was very impressed with the research, how I got it right, which was really nice to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So that aspect is more what I researched than the artist per se. I researched Impressionism and basic well-known artists so that I could have Serena give witty kind of metaphors and comparisons to artists that would just add some humor or interest to the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done something that I find interesting, and at the end of the book, you actually ask readers' input for who would you like to see Serena end up with. And as you said, this was going to be a series that would become a romance towards the end. Does this mean you haven't really decided yet as an author who she's going to end up with?
Yes. As of April 1st, I didn't even know yet if the book I was writing that was due June 1st would be the last book in the series. And like I said, I have had a lot of ideas for future stories, art crime stories. So I was leaving lots of doors open. But then I got word that, yes, book three was going to be the last. The publishers don't tend to have a lot of success with longer series mm-hmm. in keeping sales up. So I had to get the word out on social media that the vote needed to be in by May 1st, and we had a lot of interesting debate across Facebook and in the comments on the voting page, and we had people drawing up lines and starting fan clubs for Team Nate and Team Tanner, so that was a lot of fun.
I'm assuming that there was a real people were had a real vested interest in whichever one was going to end up.
Yes, it definitely is that way. Yeah. And it's a challenge for me because I'm going with the majority vote. But, of course, you're disappointing 40% of the other people who were voting the other way.
Now, how does that affect you as a writer? You know, because that kind of now ties you into a specific plot line. Does that free you to do that, or do you find that kind of binds you?
Well, I had two critique partners, one in favor of Nate and one in favor of Tanner. So all the way along, they helped me make it plausible that either one could win. And I was surprised by the vote. It didn't go the way I thought it would. And so it took a little bit of creative writing to make sure that it came out believable at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm really happy with how it went. I'm really pleased with the enthusiastic response it got, and it was a lot of fun to interact about the characters with my readers,
mm-hmm.
and they had so many ideas for the characters and for spin-offs. So maybe I'll have to do a few little extra stories. For my newsletter subscribers, I often do extra stories that I email them links to
mm-hmm.
so that they can catch up on the other people in the stories.
Right. Well, let's take one final break, and then we're going to come back and finish a conversation with author Sandra Orchard. I'm your host, Robert White, and you listen to Arts Connection on Faith FM.
With a tongue on fire.
Welcome back to Arts Connection. You've been listening to Magnolia from the Live at the Space CD by Carla Adolph. I'm your host, Robert White, and we're going to wrap up our conversation with author Sandra Orchard. Sandra, what's been the response to A Fool in His Monet right now?
It's been very enthusiastic. People are eager to see what her next case will be, Serena's next case, and to see what's going to happen with the men in her life. Aunt Martha, her zany aunt, seems to be a popular character mm-hmm. that they like to want to find out more about. And there's a little bit of mystery as to background of some of the other characters that people are eager to find out more about.
Right. When is the next novel going to be out?
Next one comes out in October. It's Another Day, Another Dali, and for Salvador Dali, and yeah. It delves into the world of art forgery.
Ah. And where can people get an idea, get a copy of the book, or where can they find out more about you?
All the books are available at all the online retailers, major Christian bookstores, Chapters, Kohl's, all carry them. Probably have to find them in their online catalog. I can be found at www.sandraorchard.com. I'm also on Facebook at facebook.com/sandraorchard. And I've actually just started on Pinterest at Author S. Orchard. And I did that to post pictures of my characters because Serena has this habit of comparing people to movie stars, and this is an ongoing theme through the stories mm-hmm. of Tanner trying to guess which movie star she thinks he looks like. So I did that for people because we don't always know these movie stars depending on how old or new the movie is compared to how old or young we are.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you very much for your time tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Arts Connection today, and thank you to my guest, Sandra Orchard. And if you miss a broadcast or want to hear it again, look for archive programs on our website at artsconnection.ca. And be sure to tune in next week for the look where faith, arts, and Canadian culture meet. For more information on Arts Connection, email robert@artsconnection.ca. Follow us on Twitter at @SayLaw13. Look for the Arts Connection page on Facebook, or check out the Arts Connection blog at blog.artsconnection.ca. For Arts Connection, I'm your host, Robert White, saying good day and God bless.